Make your next move with a beautiful website from our sponsor, Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianBooks to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
The Guardian.
Driving through Wisconsin, and just by the side of a road was parked a huge lorry trailer thing with a glass side, and in it was a reproduction, a large yellow painted polystyrene reproduction of the largest ever block of cheese made for the 1961 World's Fair. And I'm sort of, there's that point where you're going, it's not actually a block of cheese, it's a polystyrene replica of a block of cheese in a lorry parked by the side of the road that people pull up and they go and they stand there and they look at it and they go, that is what it would have looked like if we had been here and seen the largest block of cheese in 1960. And just going, I want that in my book. Mm. I want all of the things that somehow made America odd.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. This week we hear from a writer who needs both no introduction and plenty. Comics, novels, short fiction, screenwriting. Neil Gaiman has been telling stories in every modern medium for three decades. So, Sian, when he came into the studio, where did you begin?
Well, we began with his most, possibly his most pressing project, which is the adaptation of his book, American Gods.
The most pressing of many.
Yeah, he's got so many things that he's constantly working on. But American Gods has been long awaited, and it's about to start on telly all around the world on 1st of May. And people have been very, very excited about this for a long time. So we started with that and talked about both his book and how he came about writing that book, but also his involvement on the show.
And turning the book into a piece of telly.
Yeah, and his involvement in that and seeing a book that he wrote about 15 years ago, sort of the little changes that need to be made to make it reflect our modern day as opposed to, you know, the early 2000s in America. Mm.
And while we were talking about Gods, did you then move on to his latest collection of retellings?
Yeah, well, he's always had a fascination with Norse mythology, and so many Norse gods feature in American Gods. So we talked about his latest book, Norse Mythology, and the little common features that American Gods and that book share, and just what he likes about Norse gods, what distinguishes his interest between that and Egyptian gods, for example.
And then a little bit about everything else.
Yeah.
But first we'll hear you in caring mode as you inquire after his current state of jet lag.
Well, actually, I first wanted to start by asking how you are, because it seems like there's about 5 million things on the go for you at the moment, and you've been very busy and you're travelling the world, and I just wanted to ask how you are to start with.
I'm a little bit jet lagged.
Have you just come from Australia?
I've just come from Australia.
Yeah.
I was in Australia last week. And it's nice to be here. I'm sort of counting the days now until I get to stop moving. And then even that gets strange because I'm meant to be teaching for a month.
Oh, really?
Except that I've sacrificed one of the teaching weeks to going to the East Coast and then the West Coast premiere events of American Gods and doing lots of interviews. So I teach for 2 weeks, then go off and zoom around, and then I have another week's teaching.
Excellent. And then you get a break.
And then I'm done.
Okay.
I go back to being a novelist. And, you know, if you spot me in the street, it will be walking to or from somewhere, a little coffee shop that I can write in the back of or something.
I mean, yeah, the most immediate project coming up is your adaptation, the adaptation of American Gods. And I just wanted to find out what your involvement was in the end, because I did see originally that you were possibly going to write a couple of episodes, and then Brian Fuller said that you might do one in season two.
Yep. I've done little bits of writing here and there at the edges. But so the intricate and strange history of American Gods had a different company to the one that actually wound up making it, originally buying the rights, which was HBO. And I was writing the scripts, and co-writing the scripts, and I did a few scripts for them, and it became very apparent that they really didn't know what this thing was. They didn't understand it. The people who had bought it were no longer there.
So it was too weird for them, or?
The execs who now had sort of inherited it were like, we don't get this thing, and they let us have the rights back. Mm. And at that point, having written the first few scripts, I could no longer, for HBO, I could no longer be the writer.
Oh, right, I see.
So at that point, we went and we found Brian and Michael as showrunners, and it was like, you have to do all the beginning stuff, because I can't do that. I simply cannot go in and write it because I've already written it for somebody else. So what I've been doing is, I was there in helping choose Brian and Michael. I was there in helping choose the director. I was there through much of the casting process, occasionally saying yes, occasionally going no, and this is why. And then there have been little things that I've written, and sometimes I've just written them because it's easier. There's a sequence, one of the Coming to America sequences, I'd grumbled to our showrunners that I was not a big fan of the narration that had been written to accompany it. And they said, well, do you want to write it then? Mm. And I'm like, yeah, all right. So went off and just wrote a completely new narration for it and stuff. So the big trouble has been that it's the same reason that I haven't written anything for Peter Capaldi's Doctor Who. I've spent any time that I could have been writing scripts in the last 2.5 years working on Good Omens, the television adaptation of the book that I did with Terry Pratchett a long, long time ago, which the BBC is making for Amazon Prime Video.
So you get two shows on Amazon Prime.
So I will have two shows on Amazon Prime Video.
I mean, how did it come to be that Brian Fuller got picked? Because when I saw that he was going to be a showrunner, I went, that's a really good choice, because he's kind of strange enough and extravagant enough for a book like this.
We knew we needed a showrunner who, A, got it, and B, would not be intimidated by it. Because we wanted it, the book, to be not exactly yogurt starter, but something that people could add their own, use their own platform, have their own viewpoints, come in and work with. And I flew out to Toronto in April of 2014.
God, that's a while ago.
Exactly. And that was the first meeting. I think it was like 1st or 2nd of April. Meeting Brian for the first time, going, yes, I like him. By April 2015, it was a real thing, and now scripts were being written, and I was giving notes, and it was actually starting to happen. And then we had a year of casting, and April 2016, we started shooting, and very end of April, beginning of May 2017, it's going out. So it's been a sort of very steady kind of process. And in all that, Brian has been an absolute delight.
Really?
He's funny, he's easy to work with, he's mad keen and enthusiastic and just goes off and his eyes light up. And then what we're getting is glorious, so I'm happy.
When you talk to authors about being involved on adaptations or watching adaptations come and then fall away because it just something doesn't work and it doesn't happen, some authors talk about it with a great deal of frustration because they go, well, if I write a book, then the book happens. And you know, the only thing that's really required is me, whereas an adaptation requires hundreds of people and studios to be on board and everyone to be involved at the right time. Do you find it frustrating? Because you've had a few adaptations that haven't happened, but you've also had a lot of adaptations that have.
You know, I am very, very zen about these things. I know what I'm in control of. I wrote American Gods partly because in 1996 and 1997 and much of 1998, I'd spent in Hollywood, not physically in Hollywood, but working for Hollywood, writing scripts and writing outlines, and I came up with a couple of TV series and all of that kind of thing, and nothing happened. And I was so irritated that it was like, I'm going to write my book, and it will just be me, and it's not going to be, it won't have a simple three-act structure. I'm going to throw everything I want in the kitchen sink into it, and this will be my book. And that was what I did, and I went off and did that. That then got weird with American Gods, because what would happen after the book came out was I would get phone calls from directors, and they would be like real directors who I'd heard of.
Really? Can you name any of them?
Absolutely not. But they would phone up, and they would, and we would have the same conversation, which would go basically, normally it would begin, I was in an airport and I picked up American, I didn't have anything to read. I picked up American Gods. I read it. It's brilliant. And I want to turn this into a movie, but I'm not sure how. How would you do it? And I would say, well, I have no idea. If I wanted to make it movie shaped, I would have written it to be movie shaped. The whole point of it is it's this giant, messy road trip with all of this dangling stuff at the end and these short stories from across time. And that was the point. And they would go, oh, okay. And I'd never hear from them again. So the new sort of weird golden age of television that we're experiencing, suddenly everything that was a bug in American Gods became a feature, including the occasional moments of ultraviolence, including some of the weird sex, including all of the stuff where you go, well, you couldn't put that on television or whatever. It's like, oh, no, you can.
You definitely can now. I mean, and even the size of it as well. Is it true that the first season of American Gods is about a third of what you've written?
It is. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because some of the short stories that are scattered through the book occur earlier than they do. We've moved some of them earlier, so they occur in the first season rather than occurring two-thirds of the way through the book or whatever. But yeah, in terms of giant plot, for those of you who are listening who've read American Gods, we finish just before we get to the House on the Rock. Nice. So it's about a third of the book. But having said that, one of the things that we've also started doing is, because when I wrote the book, I was looking out of Shadow's head for most of the book and seeing things as Shadow, our hero, our rather shadowy hero, sees things. And the great thing about making television is I don't have to do that. So episode 4 is Laura, his ex-wife, and it begins the week before she meets him. And we learn how she meets him, and we learn what happened when he was in prison, and we learn why she got and how she got involved with his best friend, and then we learn what happens after she dies, all of that kind of stuff. Which is all implicit in the book. You'll get a sentence here or a sentence there. Mm. But now we get 50 minutes of actually getting to see this thing happen. And because Emily Browning is one of the finest actresses of our generation, it's amazing. And we also put stuff in for the people who have read the book and know it intimately, so that they don't always know what's going on or where we are. And occasionally that's just Brian and Michael intentionally screwing with their heads. And occasionally it's just that thing of going, well, we know we're going here and we're going to get to there, but let's take this little diversion first and let's see what would happen if we went there. Or occasionally it's, let's see what happened if these two characters who could have met off screen in the book actually did. There's one of my favorite scenes is Gillian Anderson as media and Bruce Langley as the technical boy having a very glorious argument in the technical boy's limo. And it's just a wonderful scene that Brian wrote, in which one of his ideas, because the first time we meet media in the book, she's Lucy from the Lucy Show on an old TV. Brian decided to take that idea and run with it. And so the first time we meet her, she's Lucy. But after that, she's a variety of other people, and they're always people who have caught the popular imagination, famous people, some of them male, some of them female, which is something I think we could only do because we had Gillian, who can be anyone and be anything.
And another character that I think, just looking at pictures and stills of Technical Boy and how he's described in the book as sort of being this obese kid in his parents' basement lurking on the internet, how that has changed with time as well since, because American Gods was
there
the 2000s.
There are lots of places where we've just gone, okay, that was me plotting a book and coming up with characters in 1998. You know, there's one line where sort of Shadow says, I suppose you must be one of those dot-coms I've heard of. And at that point, you know, the point that I wrote that, nobody used the word dot-com. It was like nice to sort of put that in, and then now that's as if he was talking about buggy whips and dinosaurs. So yeah, we went, okay, Technical Boy, who would he be now? And we're going, well, now he would be, you know, he'd be a Mark Zuckerberg. He'd be one of these irritating Silicon Valley sort of high-tech successful troll creatures who doesn't quite get it. In much the same way, honestly, that the original Technical Boy didn't quite get it. And a lot of the original, you know, the dialogue from the book is handed straight over to Bruce.
Oh, really?
It's not like we had to change a lot of that. Mm. But he's still this sort of, now he's very much, you know, back then computers were big, clunky things. Now everybody has something in their pocket that they are worshipping and giving time and attention to.
And because the book was written sort of 15 years ago now, have many of the other gods changed as well? Because the new gods are formed based on what America believes in. So
we didn't really change any of the others, although I suspect that when we get into media, we may find that there's more going on because, you know, television was a lot more important when I wrote the book than it is now, or at least broadcast television. But then... People are getting their television from other sources. Witness this. But it came out in other weird ways. For example, in the book, Laura, Shadow's wife, is a small-town travel agent. Because when I wrote the book, there were lots of small-town travel. Most every small town had its own travel agent. They've gone away. Mm-hmm. So we actually came up with a whole new life and career for her. She's now a croupier in a casino. But that's the kind of stuff where you just go, okay, well, let's. If we were doing it now, what would we do? And it involves change less than I thought it would. I think in some ways, because the ultimate takeaway of American Gods, the novel, is that the new gods are terrified. The new gods know that they are evanescent. The new gods know they are going to be replaced by the next thing. And things, you know, they talk about the railroad gods who once controlled America and are now forgotten. They will come and they will go and other things will come.
Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianBooks to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
I understand that the whole idea for the book, for American Gods, that was born, I think you said, once in an afternoon in a tourist information centre in Iceland. Is that right?
It was, although it would also be true to say that there was 6 years' worth of characters and ideas and things that I wanted to say about America, because I'd moved to America in 92 and to the Midwest and rapidly found all of these things that I had not known about or expected to see or just that were weird. The equivalent of pointing out to American friends, I'd say that lake that just froze in the winter because winters out here. I mean, even the winter. I mean, before we get to the lake. When I moved to America, being English, I thought I understood the cold. The cold is when water goes white and fluffy and puddles go hard, and that's cold. And moving to America, I said, no, that's not cold. That is the first indication that things can get cold. There is so much cold beneath freezing, and there is the point where you actually reach, you know, 0 Fahrenheit when you breathe in and you can feel all the hairs in your nose freeze. And then there's like minus 20 Fahrenheit, which is where you breathe in. It's like someone just kicked you in the lungs because it's so cold. There's all of this sort of cold beneath cold. So Village Lake, and I'd say, why is there a car out there on the ice? And they'd say, oh, well, they park it there every winter, and they put a car there, and they take bets on when it's going to fall through the ice for charity. And I'm like, isn't that weird? And everyone's going, no, I don't think so. Isn't that what everybody does? And they're like, no, that's actually kind of weird. I'm going to put that in my book because that's weird. So there was a lot of just sort of observation, a lot of going, these places are strange. I didn't put this in the book, but I remember driving through Wisconsin, and just by the side of a road was parked a huge lorry trailer thing with a glass side, and in it was a reproduction, a large yellow painted polystyrene reproduction of the largest ever block of cheese made for the 1961 World's Fair. And there's that point where you're going, it's not actually a block of cheese, it's a polystyrene replica of a block of cheese in a lorry parked by the side of the road that people pull up and they go and they stand there and they look at it and they go, that is what it would have looked like if we had been here and seen the largest block of cheese in 1960. And just going, I want that in my book. Mm. I want that sort of, all of the things that somehow made America odd. So I've been accumulating all of that. I didn't know where it went or what it did. And then I was in Iceland, and I was at a stopover in Reykjavik. I'd landed the day before at 6 o'clock in the morning. I had a plan to keep going until it got dark without realizing that 3rd of July in Reykjavik, it isn't going to get dark. Dark is simply not going to happen. So now it's the next day, and I haven't slept in 72 hours, and I'm feeling very weird, and it's Sunday, and nothing is open except the tourist information office. So I wander in there, and I'm looking at a diorama of the voyages of Leif Erikson. And there's a map showing them coming to America. And I looked at this map, and I thought, I wonder if they took their gods with them. And then I thought, I wonder if they left their gods behind when they left. And suddenly, it was like, oh, I have this giant frame. This is my story. This is everything that I've been thinking, everything I wanted to put into a book. I know what it is. And I took a couple of days. I flew from there to Oslo and drove from there to Bergen in Norway. And in Bergen, I sat down and wrote a long email to my agent and my editor saying, this is the story, this is what the thing is, this is what drives it. My working title is American Gods, but obviously I will find something better. And a week later, when I got back to America, waiting for me was a mock-up of the book's cover, which was the original American book cover. It was just the road with the lightning strike.
All right.
And it said at the top, American Gods, and at the bottom, Neil Gaiman, and it was obviously a book. And I went, oh, okay, well, it's obviously called American Gods.
Another recent release of yours is the Norse mythology book, and you have a lot of characters that we do see in American Gods, like there's Mr. Wednesday being Odin, and also Loki, who appears as Mr. World.
Spoilers. So many spoilers.
Well, I'm hoping it's mostly fans that listen to this because I haven't explained much of the plot of the book. Do you regard these characters as separate entities, or do you regard them as some sort of evolution of one character in sort of, you know, Gaiman's world?
What a lovely question. It's so strange for me right now. I'm right now, Norse mythology is out there. Somebody showed me in the bookseller yesterday that it's the best-selling fiction title in the UK of 2017. Apparently, it's the same in America. And they're saying, well, you must have expected this. I was like, no, I didn't expect it. High on the list of things that you do not expect is that your book on Norse mythology,
Good number one.
You've been working on in an incredibly lazy way since 2012, is going to come out and go to number one and then stay there. And if I'd thought that, I wouldn't have been working on it in a lazy way since 2012. I would have finished it back in 2012 and it would have been published 5 years ago. But I loved getting down and dirty in the prose edda, in the poetic edda, in being reminded of how much I love Odin, how much I love Loki, how much I love these characters. I think it's probably good grounding. If you're going to watch American Gods, it is not a wrong thing to have read Norse mythology.
Mm-hmm.
That will give you some background and an advantage. And it'll also tell you a little about things that you might otherwise find a bit misleading. You know, the Odin of American Gods is a lot closer to Snorri's Odin, the classical Odin, than he is to, you know, Anthony Hopkins in the comics, playing basically this beneficent, one-eyed, fundamentally a force for good. You know, Odin, the Odin of Snorri, is not necessarily fundamentally a force for good. He is a force for his own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And what his own agenda is his own agenda. And that's his business. And yes, Wednesday in this.
He's a bit closer to the original.
Closer to the original, I think. Mm.
I mean, another character in American Gods is Mr. Nancy, who's a Nancy, who you've also written about in the Nancy Boys. Have you ever been tempted to do something like what you did with North mythology, but do it for African lore or for...
It's interesting. One thing I loved doing in the Nancy Boys was retelling Anansi stories and telling them my own way, adding my own little spin to them. You're sort of, there's a weird level on which, last time I went to the Philippines, I had a lot of Filipino writers and just fans coming up to me and saying, you love Filipino myth. You love all of our amazing monsters and weirdnesses. And I'm like, yes, I really do, because I really do. They have the best monsters in the Philippines. They have the best.
Really?
They have these glorious sort of vampire witches who their top half takes off and flies, leaving their legs behind, and they have these long tongues that will sort of vampire you and suck out your blood and creep up into where you're. I mean, it's amazing. And that you have these horse-headed, glorious horse-headed creatures who smoke cigars and will get you into trouble. They're fantastic mythology. And they were like, well, will you do, you know, why don't you do Filipino mythology? And I'm like, because you people should.
Mm.
Because you need to do fantastic Filipino mythology stuff and then send it out to the world. It is yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose you could turn around and go, do you think that of the Norse and the Icelandics and stuff? And I kind of go, well, yes, I kind of do. But also, this was my favorite mythology since I was 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I just loved the idea of going, okay, well, these stories are out there, and they're out there in lots of retellings, and the Snorri, the prose edda has been there for, you know, about 1,000 years at this point. Why not just retell the stories as if they were campfire stories and send them out into the world?
One thing I did see that you posted online recently was that you've been going onto Amazon and looking at the 1-star reviews of Norse mythology. Why have you been doing that? Don't do that.
It was because it was fairly in the sort of the fairly early days. There comes a very, very quick point for me with Amazon reviews where I don't actually read them. I just look at the little pattern of, okay, is this getting, you know, okay, a lot more people like this than don't. It's got a lot of 5-star reviews, a lot of 4-star reviews, handful of 3 stars, almost no 2 stars, and there's a couple of 1 stars or whatever. But in the very early days, I was just really interested in what are people saying? Mm. These are people who bought it. What do they think? And clicking on the 1-star reviews of Norse mythology, they had something in common, which is people were going, this is just a book of Norse mythology. This is like Norse tales that Neil Gaiman has retold, and it's mythology. And I'm going, I just wasn't sure how much clearer I could have been in the book title being Norse mythology. The description of the book is Neil retells, it's like, didn't we do that?
Yeah.
Didn't we explain that? So it was just a little bit like people who've gone out and bought pizza and now are complaining that it's round and flat and covered with tomato and cheese. You're going, well, yes, it is. I'm sorry.
Another thing you mentioned before you're working on now is the adaptation of Good Omens. And you once said that your favorite line that you've ever written was a line in American Gods, which is the line, Chicago happened slowly like a migraine, which is a beautiful line. But my favorite joke you've ever written is in Good Omens, but I'm unsure whether it's one you've actually managed to translate into the new adaptation, because it's the joke about every car in Britain having the Queen's Greatest Hits cassette in it.
It's one that, at least in the current draft of the script, I've kind of let go, but, you know, we definitely want to go and talk to the guys in Queen and say, is there any way that we can have some Queen stuff going on and stuff? It is one of those weird things where, on the one hand, the adaptation of Good Omens is obscenely faithful.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are things that I wound up doing in order to move it from one medium to another, where just sometimes things would have to go, and occasionally new things would have to come. I wrote a 25-minute long mini movie at one point, which is just the history of Crowley and Aziraphale and their relationship from the Garden of Eden until now, going through, you know, Noah's Ark and the crucifixion and Nero's Rome and Arthurian Britain and, you know, the first performance of Hamlet and Victorian, you know, you just sort of follow them through the 1960s, and it's enormous fun. But there were some things that it was like, okay, this is a fantastic joke. I just don't know how I can either get it in, or in one case, I cannot stop the action. There's a bit in I think, episode 4, maybe episode 5, where everybody is heading towards Tadfield and things are getting really bad and the pace is just picking up, and we have this lovely Gardener's Question Time thing in the book, and we stop for an episode of Gardener's Question Time, but it's this end of the world Gardener's Question Time, so they're dealing with fools of fish and and stuff, and I think I'm allowed to say this now. That was a sequence that I wrote in the original book. It was a sequence that I'm still incredibly proud of. I think it's hilarious. I love it. And given the tension and what's happening and how fast we're moving between people, I was like, I couldn't stop and do 5 minutes of Gardener's Question Time. It had to go. But again, there's stuff in Good Omens that, even if you are one of those people who has, over the last however many years, bought 5 copies of Good Omens because they kept getting lent to friends and you only have 1 copy left and it's at some point been dropped in the bath and at other times been dropped in soup and it's held together by sellotape and string and you've read it that often, and the pages are a sort of really suspicious yellow color. Even those people will find things that they will be excited about in the Good Omens adaptation. A lot of it is stuff that Terry and I had just talked about over the years. And some of it is also stuff that I stole from the sequel that we never wrote.
Oh, really?
Because Terry and I plotted you know, a giant sequel to Good Omens.
Oh, God.
And then we never wrote it because life got too busy and we wound up on different continents and there was never any time. You know, when we did Good Omens, I was a young journalist who'd just been able to give up journalism to write comics, and Terry had just left his job at the Central Electricity Generating Board as a PR and had gone full-time to write, and nobody expected anything of us. We weren't famous, and we just quietly sat down and wrote this book that we didn't even know if anybody was gonna publish. I wrote it to make Terry laugh, and Terry wrote his bits to make me laugh, and it was very simple. And at the point where we sort of looked around and went, we could actually do the sequel, we were like, yeah, but lawyers would have to talk for a month before we're allowed in the same room, and how do we get to the same continent? And we don't have 2 hours a day to just be on the phone with each other and all of that kind of thing. So, but I went and sort of borrowed stuff that we'd continued elaborating on and had continued thinking about with regard to how the cosmology of Good Omens, and that was really fun.
So that's due out in 2018. I think that's
we should begin the casting process in a couple of weeks' time.
Oh,
so
fantastic!
I'm getting a director and just starting it. So yeah, I would say probably end of 2018.
So I think basically, so you've got Good Omens possibly in 2018. We've got How to Talk to Girls at Parties.
That'll be coming this summer.
This summer, fantastic. Yeah. And we've got American Gods, which is end of April in America, but 1st of May on Amazon Prime in the UK.
Exactly.
And in terms of books, I mean, you've got Seven Sisters. What you're working on now?
That's what I'm working on now. Okay. That's my book that I'm writing. That's my book that I'm grumpy that I haven't written anything on in 8 days now, and I'm very much looking forward to settling down on Wednesday and getting back to my novel and the hopes that it is still waiting for me when I get there. It's feeling like a real book.
Yeah.
No, it's funny because going back to Neverwhere, I'd been wanting to do a story of the Seven Sisters for a very long time. But nothing was particularly impelling me back, and there were always other things to do. And I think it was working with refugees. It was that point of going out to the refugee camps. It was the point of looking around at London right now and going, the London of now is not quite the London of 1996 when I wrote Neverwhere. And that's interesting to me.
Because, I mean, you're not based here anymore. When you come back, what do you notice that's different to you?
I think there's a level on which things move faster here. You're losing, or it feels like you're losing a lot of the weirder, shabbier, but shabby attractive because old parts of London. Things are getting cleaned up. There are Costas everywhere and Starbucks where they aren't Costas, and that's all happening. But at the same time, it feels like the level of poverty and the level of desperation involved with the homeless, with the dispossessed, with the people who have fallen through the cracks is actually more painful. You know, it was bad in 96. I mean, I think it one of the things that pushed me into Neverwhere originally was just working, doing stuff with Comic Relief over here and watching and getting involved in what Comic Relief was doing for homelessness at that time in the UK, and now looking around and going, this is kind of worse. The poverty line is a lot closer, and the safety nets, which even at that time were disappearing, are sort of fading away. There are levels on which in some ways it feels more like Victorian Britain. Although if you go back and look at Victorian Britain, you're going, well, at least, you know, there are things that we still aren't quite there. Probably a good thing that we're not sending 5 and 6 year old kids out to sell nuts and oranges on the streets. And maybe make a penny profit to bring home. But you're still going, it is not good.
Mm.
But at the same time, you have these strange gulfs. And you also have all this stuff that we genuinely don't know. It's complicated.
Yeah.
We're in big, complicated machines that are failing. And that seemed like a lovely place to, as a writer, just to get in there and try and talk about that stuff. And talk about refugees and talk about what's happening. So that sent me back into the world of Neverwhere. And there was probably about a chapter's worth of faffing around, of sort of going, is this what the characters sound like? Is this what the place is like? And now, several more chapters on, and I'm going, feels like Neverwhere to me.
That was Neil Gaiman speaking with Sean Kane. Norse Mythology is published by Bloomsbury, and his adaptation of American Gods, as we said earlier, airs around the world on the 1st of May.
But before you go, we thought we'd bring the Global Development podcast made here at The Guardian to your attention. One great episode focuses on feminists in Africa. While gender equality remains a distant dream for many women in Africa, this particular podcast speaks with amazing people who have been working very hard to bring change. To have a listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Which is where, of course, you'll find us too. Or you can spark up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can join in the conversation as well, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Richard Lee.
And me, Sean Kane.
And our silent producer, Susanna Tresillian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.